Hello and welcome to Chess Pulse. I'm Dr. Mary Beth Scholin, and joining me today are Drs. Julie Morissette and Dr. Eyodeji Adegonsoy. Today, we are excited to present and discuss diagnostic excellence for interstitial lung diseases. And this is part of the series, How We Do It, Chess Experts Weigh In. This is part of a project that is funded in part by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation through a grant program administered by the Council of Medical Specialty Societies. I am Mary Beth Scholin, and I'm an interstitial lung disease pulmonologist at the University of Utah. And joining me are my guests. I'd like for them to introduce themselves.
I'm Julie Marseille. I'm a pulmonologist in Montreal at the University of Montreal, and I'm an associate editor for Chess Journal for the diffuse lung disease section.
And hi, everyone. I'm Deji Adegunsoy, pulmonologist at the University of Chicago, where I also serve as the scientific director of the Interstitial Lung Disease Program. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Drs. Morissette and Adegunsoy, welcome to the program. So to begin our discussion today, we have lots to talk about, but let's start with something that is near and dear to all of us, the early diagnosis of interstitial lung diseases. Now, this is really essential, or at least we all believe it's essential, to identify this disease early and to begin slowing the disease progression, thereby lessening symptom severity. However, I think that many of us know that lots of our ILD patients don't really receive this diagnosis until years after they initially present. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Do you two have ideas about why this might be occurring?
That's an excellent question. And I think, like you said, there are potentially some various answers to it. I think it's at different levels in the care that patient can access. So first, I think there need to be more awareness to ILD because the symptoms in pulmonary are so not specific. So people are going to have shortness of breath and it's going to be insidious, or they're going to have some coughing. And oftentimes it's not going to be, ILD won't be the first diagnosis that comes to mind. So I think it's very important that in primary care, in pulmonary and emergency, that people know about ILD and know that those symptoms should have you think a little bit of ILD, even if it's not going to be the first diagnosis for many people. And I think it's important that people know that they, when they suspect ILD, that it's very important to order a chest CT and to refer to pulmonary for a complete evaluation. So I think that's part of the answer. And I think additionally to that, what's confusing is that our field has changed a lot in the last 10 years. There's been new names for diseases, new treatments, new disease categories. And I think it's kind of confusing to integrate all of that together. We're lucky enough that there has been several guidelines that has been published to help us diagnose different type of ILDs, but all of those guidelines kind of focus on one disease. And it can be hard when you're in clinic with one patient and you're trying to decide which way this is going to go. And I think that's one of the missing piece right now, is to how integrate all of those information together so that it can be clinically useful and meaningful when you're dealing with one-to-one patient.
Yeah, Dr. Morissette really nicely captured most of the facets to this. There are many nuances to this diagnostic delay that you pointed out just earlier on, Dr. Scholin. One of the areas that we often try to wrap our heads around and grapple with is the fact that ILD is very frequently considered a black box by primary care providers. And in the short time frame they have to, make the diagnosis and address patients' concerns, ILD, with all its complexity, makes it much more challenging for physicians and care providers to actually go through the motions to arrive at the right diagnosis. In fact, there's data that suggests that from the first symptom a patient has to the first CT scan, often takes about 13 months. And from that first CT scan to the time they actually have defined progression of ILD, another 11 months. So in that time frame, you already have lost 24 months or 2 years before you start addressing progression of disease. So I think the complexity of the disease itself, the fact that we don't have appropriate access to care or access to diagnostic tests, also contributes to this delay. There is also the issue of unaddressed disparities that impact diverse populations. I think this is really of key importance. These disparities are often multifaceted, and they very frequently include socioeconomic factors, racial factors, gender and neighborhood disparities, to name a few. And all of these very frequently impact multiple aspects of ILD diagnosis and management as well. I'm talking about things that include access to care, symptom recognition, diagnostic imprecision, and misdiagnosis. All of these culminate in diagnostic delays. So I think that improved awareness, better understanding of the nuances of these diverse populations, and better approaches to mitigating these different aspects of disparities could help to substantially improve the time to ILD diagnosis. And doing that, we can cut back on the detrimental outcomes that we all too often encounter in our routine day-to-day clinical practice.
These are such good points that you're talking about. I mean, it really is complicated, and you bring out the fact that there's, you know, a distribution of specialists that's not equal, right? I mean, there's, you know, big concentrations in cities where we have specialists that just only do interstitial lung disease, and then spread out throughout the country, there's areas where there's sparse medical representation whatsoever. So it's very hard to, you know, keep that access and that knowledge equal. But if you were to give advice to any provider who's seeing a patient, you know, could you boil down, you know, simply when we should be suspecting ILD? What kind of symptoms and signs, and what would you advise anybody to find this disease? When should we suspect it?
I think, again, that's an excellent question, and one that's not easy to pinpoint like a quick recipe to always that's going to include everybody. But I think insidious symptoms of shortness of breath and cough. And I think one of the key finding on physical exam would be to identify crackles. So I think when you combine all of this, and like, I think the threshold for obtaining a CT scan should be potentially lower than it is right now, because that's the way that we're going to identify ILD on those patients. So I think that should be one of the key factors. The other thing is, like, for every patient that I've known disease that can be associated with ILD, like connective tissue disease, for example. So I think when those patients develop symptoms of shortness of breath, the thresholds would be even lower to try and see if they do have ILD.
Yeah, I agree. Symptoms like dyspnea, that's shortness of breath, dyspnea on exertion or even at rest, cough, typically non-productive, weight loss, easy fatigability, digital clubbing where the terminal aspects of our fingers appear like little clubs. All of these are early telltale signs of ILD that not just patients, but care providers should also be concerned about. In specific subpopulations, connective tissue features, like Dr. Morris already said, like Raynaud's phenomenon, the terminal aspect of our fingers look blue or white, particularly in cold conditions. Inflammatory signs like arthralgia, joint aches and pains, arthritis, dry mouth, dry eyes, skin rash. All of these are frequently telltale signs that we encounter in those autoimmune varieties of ILD. And so when we see those features, our antenna should flag, and, you know, our radar should alert us as to the possible underlying process of ILD that may be going on in the lungs when these features are observed systemically. Patients who have exertional desaturation, so where they have a pulse oximetry in their finger and it drops by 3 percentage points or more, when you have this in the context of any of these symptoms, I personally feel that this should trigger a suspicion of ILD. There's data that supports that now. And it should really start to necessitate careful workup. Like Dr. Morris said, getting a CT scan of the chest, a high resolution CT scan, especially when these symptoms cannot be attributed to other common cardiopulmonary causes. That, I think, would help us a lot in dropping that delay, cutting back the time to diagnosis, so we can intervene at a much earlier time point.
Yes, no, I think that's great points. And I, Julie said it right. There's no perfect recipe, but certainly taking a symptom of shortness of breath with exertion seriously, listening to lungs, picking up crackles. Every provider has a stethoscope. Listening at the base of those lungs can be a really good start. And then moving from there into the subgroups and et cetera. So it's a challenge to detect the disease. There's also just a challenge in the diagnosis of the specific ILD. And I think we alluded to this earlier. Our guidelines are you know, we ourselves are changing within the ILD world. We have some guidelines, but it's tricky. Can we highlight, you know, for our audience a little bit, some of what, even the challenges that we face and our understanding of the challenges that our colleagues across the country face trying to make this diagnosis?
I think this, for the gold standard for the diagnosis of ILD, if we look at most guidelines, it remains multidisciplinary discussion where we meet with all the teams. So pulmonologists, radiologists, pathology, rheumatology. And I think this key meeting is probably not, or it's not available in many areas outside of academic centers. And I think that's what one part that it's challenging. It's challenging when you have it to coordinate a time for everybody to meet, but it's also very challenging when it's not available to you. I think it's, we rely a lot on the integration of clinical and radiology and pathology to obtain a diagnosis. And I think we know that that's the best way to make the diagnosis, but practically it's not something that's simple to achieve. And I think that remains a challenge for everyone.
Yeah, I agree. I believe it's important for care providers, physicians, and other practitioners alike to update their knowledge. I think this is critical for better understanding of practical ways to implement these guidelines, because the field is constantly evolving, particularly in ILD. I think this is really a nice place that CHEST really helps us a lot, because the annual meetings are a wonderful platform to get consistent, accurate updates on how we should be practicing medicine, pulmonary medicine, but ILD in particular. There's also the aspect of pretest probability, which I think is quite often higher in certain demographic subpopulations. Very frequently, we know that patients who self-identify in the US as older white males are more likely to have IPF. Younger Black females are more likely to have autoimmune forms of ILD. And there's data that suggests that Hispanic populations in the US, and especially in South American nations like Brazil, and also recently in India as well, these have a very high frequency of hypersensitivity pneumonitis, HP. So all of these can help, you know, prompt appropriate workup to identify causative factors, streamline management of ILD, particularly in the context of the existing guidelines that we have.
Yes, excellent points all. I just want to bring up that for those that are just tuning in, you're listening to CHEST Pulse. I'm Dr. Scholin, and today I'm speaking with Drs. Julie Morrissey and Dr. Desjee Degansoy about diagnostic excellence for ILDs. I wanted to circle back to something we talked about earlier. We highlighted that there are a number of disparities we need to address when it comes to ensuring that patients with ILD get the best possible care. Can we talk a little bit more about some examples of these disparities and offer some ideas about how we might improve equity for ILD patients?
Desjee, I'll let you go on this one since you're our expert on the topic.
Oh, I don't know if I'm an expert on the topic. I just have an interest in this because I think we can do a lot better. We can do so much better for the good of our patients across board. And that question, I think, is really important because there are ways, there are practical ways that we can improve these disparities. But I think the first point, the first step, is recognizing and acknowledging that there are disparities in care. We alluded to a few of this earlier on, disparities in racial demographics, in gender and sex annotations, disparities in neighborhood and rural versus urban location or residence of patients. All of these are aspects that contribute to the inequities that we very frequently see. We can do a better job of recognizing these disparities, but also improving, you know, access to care for patients where there are disparities in place. There is the aspect of affordability of diagnostic imaging that we very frequently see. Very few patients who are in the minority subpopulations or in this gender and sex disparity regions have access or can afford diagnostic imaging, CT scans. I think there are policies that can be implemented on a broader scale to help mitigate these disparities. The policies can be from a rural, from a county level to states to federal government levels to help improve access to care, improve access to insurance, and also help put in policies in place to really reduce the challenges that we have where patients are exposed to environmental or occupational factors that help to propagate their fibrotic lung disease. So I'm talking about things like air pollution. Recently, we realized that there was a mandate here in the US to drop the PM 2.5 levels, acceptable levels, by a substantial amount. That is an important first step. It's clearly because we now know that PM 2.5 and other ultra fine particulate matter contributes to worsening fibrotic lung disease, not just susceptibility to ILD. That's an important first step. So things like that can really help to mitigate the detrimental outcomes that we see in fibrotic lung disease. There's also the aspect of access to antifibrotic therapy. These are expensive medications. Patients are often placed on medications that slow down the fibrotic process and slow down the lung function decline that we see in ILD. Immunomodulatory therapies, biologic agents, these are things that we constantly use to help improve the quality of life of our patients and hopefully improve their longevity, improve mortality rates that we see. But very frequently, these are very expensive medications as well. So improving access to antifibrotic therapy can actually help to mitigate the disparities. Advanced therapeutic options like lung transplantation, we know there are inequities with that, not just from a racial standpoint, but also from a rural urban standpoint. So improving these advanced therapeutic options can also go a long way towards mitigating the disparities we talked about. And I'll also just point out really quickly that there are nuances of recognizing fibrotic features, both on CT scan and on the other advanced diagnostic techniques, but also thinking about who truly has lung function impairment. The most common way we do that is using pulmonary function tests. And these PFTs are calculated using equations. There's been a huge shift in the last 5 years, particularly here in the US, moving away from race-specific equations towards race-neutral equations. Because when you race-correct or race-adjust, we often miss a substantial proportion of the population that truly has lung function impairment. And that propagates the disease progression further down the line so that we pick it up when it's often too late. And then we intervene too little, too late. And so I think these are practical steps that can be taken to help improve the inequities that we see and hopefully thus improve outcomes in ILD.
That's an excellent sweeping, analysis of all the possible ways that we can improve this. So I really appreciate hearing that. And, but I think it starts with what you started the conversation with, which just is awareness amongst experts about where disparities exist so we can help mitigate those, but also awareness for providers who are taking care of patients who maybe don't have the same access to care to have them understand this disease more and more. So education like we're doing today, I think is really invaluable. And along those lines, what other resources can we highlight for our audience that pulmonologists, other clinicians can turn to so they can help themselves understand? Where is there additional information on the diagnosis and management of ILDs? Do you have some thoughts on that?
So to add to what Deji said about the CHESS meetings that offer great session on ILD diagnosis and management, there are a couple of opportunities that are going to come in the next couple of months. So there will be a new series in CHESS Journal that's going to highlight a series of four papers on diagnostic excellence in ILD. There would be introducing editorial that's going to get published in the upcoming May issue of the CHESS Journal. Those are four very different papers that highlight different topic of ILD diagnosis from radiology to integration of guidelines. And I think they're really helpful in helping us deal with our patient clinically day to day. And also to come a bit with that unmet need that there are some practical guidelines for disease and not for all ILDs. CHESS will be releasing a resource document online with the goal to help clinicians navigate all of those ILD guidelines and kind of put them together in the clinical setting. So it's going to be available on chessnet.org when that's going to be available later this summer.
Those are wonderful resources, Judy. I think they'll be very excellent to help pulmonologists and clinicians find additional information on ILD management. I also believe that in addition to these wonderful resources, in the last few years, we've seen several reliable sites that provide accurate information for clinicians and non-clinicians alike, like the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, like the American Thoracic Society, American Lung Association. These can provide patients and care providers with really accurate, really updated information on how best to diagnose and manage the whole spectrum of interstitial lung diseases.
Yes, fabulous resources. And you know, we great highlighting things that have already been published, but also new things to come. I think these practical guidelines will be really, really helpful for all of us. So any last thoughts from my guests?
Yeah, thanks for inviting us to this wonderful podcast. I would implore our patients when they have cough or symptoms that may be suggestive of ILD to push their providers more and ask them, is this possibly something that's not asthma, that's not COPD? We know that not all cough is asthma, not all cough is CHF. And so just taking that extra measure to look a little bit deeper, explore a little bit more closely and ask ourselves, is this fibrotic lung disease, can go a long way to improving outcomes.
Thank you both for joining me. Thanks to my guests, Dr. Julie Morrissey and Dr. Desjee Degansoy, for joining us in today's discussion. It was really great speaking with everyone today. And thanks to all of you for listening to Chest Pulse.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. This was great.
Yeah, thank you.